Thank you, Rabbi Kelman. My name is Warren Goldstein. I'm a neurologist. I practice here in Toronto. I have an interest in Jewish medical ethics, and I want to thank Rabbi Kelman for the opportunity of being the moderator. We have a fascinating program tonight. I want to say some thank yous at the beginning. A thank you to Dr. Ellen Werner and Dr. Jeff Lipton, who a lot of this is their brainchild. Thank you to Ferring Pharmaceuticals, who gave us sponsorship, which allowed us to put the program together. Thanks to our speakers, and thanks to all of you. So the way the evening is going to go is like this. We have four speakers that I'm about to introduce, but to summarize, one is a physician, one is someone who does counseling in the area of infertility, one is a lawyer who specializes in this area, one is a rabbi with a special interest in this area. The four speakers are each going to speak for approximately 8 to 10 minutes to give an introductory address. So it'll take us about 40, 45 minutes. And Jewish math, 4 times 8 is something like 45. And after that, we're going to have a break for about 10 minutes. And then we're going to have a special online presentation after the break. And after that, our speakers are going to present case studies that deal with all of these issues in infertility and reproductive biology and the ethics of those areas. And the various speakers will comment on the cases. And the audience will be invited to participate. And if in terms of questions, I would ask if you try to keep your questions to the end of each speaker's talk, and maybe we'll just at that point it'll be only points of clarification. Okay, we're not going into details about tangents at that point in time. The discussion about tangents will go on in the case studies. Okay, so our first speaker is Dr. Cliff Liebrath, who is a medical doctor. He's an obstetrician gynecologist who did his training here in Toronto. And in addition to training as an obstetrician gynecologist, he then went on to specialty sub-certification and certified as a specialist in reproductive endocrinology and infertility. He did that training at the University of California in San Francisco. And now he heads up the Sunnybrook and Women's College Hospital Fertility Center and the Canadian Reproductive Assisted Technology IVF, in vitro fertilization program here in Toronto. And he's an associate professor at the university, and he really has helped a lot of people with a lot of problems. And I think you'll find his talk to be very interesting. So without any further ado, Cliff.
Thank you. Can somebody change the slides for me, or can I do it from here? Okay, why don't I do that? Thank you very much. I have the duty of telling you about infertility in about 10 minutes, so that's a difficult task. Of course, the technology is not working. Sorry, guys, just a second. All right, thank you very much. I know that many of you in the audience here are probably not suffering from infertility. I can probably tell that. although maybe some of you are. And those of you that aren't probably know very little about this subject. And those of you that are probably have read everything on the internet about it and probably may know more than I do. So we've got probably a big range of knowledge in this area. So I'm just going to try and start off just with some basics about this subject. And in terms of infertility, it's defined as the inability to conceive after 1 year of unprotected intercourse. And it affects about 15% of all couples. So about 1 in 6 of all couples that are trying to conceive will have this problem. And that's overall because if you look at women that are much older, and older ages, I should say, they're going to have a much higher rate of infertility. And if you look at this graph, it shows what happens as a couple starts to try to conceive. And I don't know if I have a pointer. I guess not. I'll just point here. Basically, if you have a couple that's been trying to conceive for the first month, about 20 to 25% of them will conceive. And after about 6 months, 60%, and then after 12 months, 85%, which leaves us with those 15% of couples who have difficulty conceiving. Now, this is at an average age of about 35. But if you look at the incidence of infertility as a woman ages, you can see that this significantly increases so that at a woman who's at 40 years of age, her risk of infertility is over 25%. So a quarter of those people will have difficulty conceiving. And the basic reason for this is because as you age, the eggs become more abnormal. There's an increased risk of the eggs having abnormal chromosomes or genetic components inside them. The other problem as you get older is that there is an increased risk of miscarriage. And that's because these abnormal eggs, most of them when they fertilize, will not result in a baby. They're not compatible with life. So that at over 40, about one-third of all the pregnancies conceived will end up as a miscarriage. So when we look at the reasons why people have infertility, we divide it into various categories. And I like to divide into these five categories to make it simple. First of all, a woman has to ovulate in order to get pregnant. And so an egg has to be released during her menstrual cycle. Then she has to have tubes which carry the egg down to the uterus to meet with the sperm. Another cause of infertility, which is sort of an unrelated one, which is a very common condition we see, is called endometriosis, and I'll discuss that in a second. We also have to have the sperm and the egg meet at the right time, and we have to have the cervix that allows the sperm to get through, and the uterus has to be able to carry a baby. And lastly, we have to have enough semen, enough sperm, to be able to fertilize an egg and create a baby. So you can see that the first four are more female causes, and the last one is the male causes of infertility. And about 40% of the time it's the male and about 60% is the female. And there's definite overlap so that there are cases where there are more than one cause. So if we look at this briefly, ovulation factor, the question really is the woman ovulating and how regularly is she ovulating? And there are many causes of ovulation problems that we see. The most common by far is called polycystic ovary syndrome. And actually, this is more common in Ashkenazi Jewish women than in other ethnic groups. And there's another cause of ovulation dysfunction called congenital adrenal hyperplasia, which is also more common in Ashkenazi Jewish women. These causes of infertility are mostly diagnosed with blood testing and ultrasound. And the picture I just showed was a woman with polycystic ovary syndrome. The next cause is tubal factor. So the question really here is, are the tubes open or are they blocked or have scarring around them that don't allow them to function properly? And the most common causes of problems with the fallopian tubes are infection and previous surgery. And you can see here on the bottom left of the screen, there's a test that we do to test whether the tubes are open. It's called a hysterosalpingogram. It's a long name for basically an x-ray of the tubes. And what happens is we put a dye up through the cervix, and then that dye then floats through the tubes, and we take an x-ray as that dye comes through the tubes to see if the tubes are open. And on the bottom right, you'll have to take my word for it, is what an ultrasound looks like of a blocked tube that's filled with fluid called the hydrosalpinx. And basically those women would have trouble wouldn't be able to get pregnant without either repair of their tubes or bypass with in vitro fertilization. The next cause that I just mentioned was endometriosis, and this is an unusual disease that we don't really know what causes it, but what we believe is that it's caused by the menstrual flow back going backwards through the fallopian tubes into the pelvic area and basically causing a toxicity to the eggs and sperm and embryos. So just showing on the bottom left of the screen, you can see that the blood has two ways it can go. It can go through the cervix, and you see it as menstrual flow, but it can also flow through the tubes back into the pelvic cavity and can result in this implants of tissue into the pelvis that are toxic to the eggs and sperm and embryos. And then in terms of the cervical factor, basically we're looking at whether the sperm can get to the right place at the right time. In other words, is intercourse being timed properly? And does it make it through the cervical mucus? The sperm must be able to, and of course I've drawn this sperm much bigger than it really is, but can the sperm really get through the mucus into the uterine cavity? That's a pretty big one. Looking here, this is an example of how we can test this. If you look on the screen, on the one on the bottom right of the screen, you can see here that what happens is when you put the sperm and the mucus together, it forms these incredible sort of passageways through the mucus that we call phalanx. And they make their way through the mucus in order to get through into the uterine cavity. And the mucus itself is a protection for the woman against infection, but during the time of her ovulation, it changes to a consistency that's like a watery, egg white, stretchy mucus consistency and basically allows the sperm to get through. But in a woman who has mucus that doesn't allow the sperm to get through, we see this picture on the bottom left where the sperm basically goes right up against the mucus and is unable to penetrate through at all. So this woman would be infertile because her mucus is not allowing the sperm to get through. What about male factor? Well, we have basic tests for male factor, and that's a semen analysis. And basically, we know that some sperm problems are treatable. There are types of infections or blockages, etc., that are treatable. But in most cases that we see, we must use what is present. In other words, we have to utilize techniques to enhance the odds of conception and fertilization of the egg. There are new tests that we're doing called sperm DNA fragmentation that are also looking at the ability of the sperm, the DNA inside the sperm, to see whether it can actually produce a baby by fertilizing the egg. And then when we talk about treatments, basically there are the low-tech treatments that we'll be talking about today. Most of those people that don't conceive do so with basic treatments, and they may include things like just counseling in terms of timing, not using lubricants that could kill the sperm, stress reduction techniques, and medications that will induce ovulation and treat various medical problems that can cause infertility. As well, in terms of surgery, we can sometimes repair various problems in the woman's pelvis to allow her to conceive. We also can do artificial insemination in cases that I showed you before where the mucus is poor or whether there's a low sperm count that won't allow the sperm to get through. In terms of more advanced treatments, these are the ones that most people sort of think about when they think about fertility, although I want to stress that most people don't require these. But basically, in vitro fertilization, which we'll talk about today, IVF with ICSI, or intracytoplasmic sperm injection, we're also going to discuss in one of our cases. And then there's the more sort of complex and other types of treatments that involve things that are very complex in terms of ethnic and religious issues, that are things like oocyte donation, sperm donation, embryo donation, and gestational surrogacy. So I'm going to stop there before we get to our first case and allow my co-speakers to give a little introduction themselves. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Cliff. Okay. So our next speaker is somebody, Jan Silverman, who works with Cliff and at that clinic at Women's College Hospital. She's an infertility counselor and a reproductive health educator, and has worked at Women's College for 15 years and has 25 years experience in the field. And someone who works with her closely has told me that she has touched the hearts of many, many people over the years. She actually has personal experience with infertility and has two children, adult children, through adoption. And her education includes two master's degrees, and she's going to tell us a bit about her role as an infertility counselor.
Thank you. Can I stay here?
Sure.
Do I have to stand? Is it working? It's on? I'm loud? I'm loud? Okay, good. Anyway, from my perspective, you heard Dr. Liebreck define infertility as an inability to conceive after 1 year of unprotected intercourse. From my psychosocial perspective, I tend to think of infertility as a frustrated desire to have a genetically linked child. And sometimes that's hard to put a date on, and it's hard to limit to just having a child, because often it can be having one child and then having difficulty conceiving a second or a third child. So in my field, we're looking at more of the desire as opposed to the medical definition. Because infertility is what we think of as a biopsychosocial phenomena. There is not one aspect of life that is not impacted by a diagnosis of infertility. And yet infertility is something that remains often extremely hidden for women and for men. And I will suggest, for many, many reasons in this community, because we bring to it a sense of confusion, of shame, of feeling that we're silenced, feeling that we're something different, feeling that we're an other. I tend to think of infertility as what I call a relational disorder, because I think of it as it impacts on our relationship with ourselves, our relationship with significant others, and our relationship with society as a whole. And I just want to talk about these three aspects for just a couple of moments. When I think about our, and by our I mean the infertile woman, because as I was in my, defined in my introduction, I am an infertile woman. So I think about it as our being both infertile women and infertile men, and how it impacts on my relationship with myself. And when I say me, I don't have every pathology that I'm going to talk about. Don't get too worried. But I'm talking about all the people that I've heard over the many, many years in the field. So when I think about how it impacts on my sense of self, it's that question of, if I can't have children, am I really a woman? What does it mean to be a woman? How do we define womanness? This is the one unique thing that only a woman can do, which is to have a baby. If I can't do this, what can I do? And if I can't succeed in this, which so many people do so easily, then how does this extend to other aspects of my life and being? And how can I succeed in anything if I cannot succeed in this basic of all life functions? It impacts on my looking at myself and my body and thinking, what is wrong with me? What is wrong? Why is this body not functioning properly? And again, over and over, what did I do to deserve this sort of a punishment? Why is this happening to me? Often it requires changing the way you have done things and seen yourself doing things. So, for example, many of my clients will walk in and say, I've always lived a good life, a clean life, a simple life. I don't smoke, I don't drink, I don't do anything that's clearly wrong. And yet now, I'm not being told by the doctor to drink or smoke, but I am being told by the doctor to do drugs, to come in and have tests done, to do things that are so contrary to the way that I commonly live my life. And again, it's looking at myself and thinking, this isn't me. Often the impact will be that I'm no longer comfortable doing things that I often enjoy doing. So, for example, I always loved children. But now, because I am so afraid that I'm not going to have the family that I hoped and dreamed I was going to have, I no longer want to be amongst children any longer. So there's a whole change to the way I view myself in terms of how I once knew myself. Second aspect is about relationship with significant others. So the first aspect of significant others is our friends and family. So first of all, as we all know, we get married, we expect to have a family, and all our friends get married at about the same time, and everyone goes off and starts having their family, and it's not happening to us. It's not happening to me. And slowly but surely, I lose a sense of having anything to do or anything in common with my friends because they're having families and I can't share that part of what's going on in their lives any longer. I now feel like an other. When their women are all getting together and talking about family and raising their families, I can't share in that experience. So slowly I begin to isolate myself from those sorts of situations, and I no longer go out with my friends. I no longer feel comfortable. I'm separate. I'm not feeling comfortable. Likewise with family members, what happens when your younger sister gets pregnant before you do? And you want to share in her joy, but you're also feeling your own pain so intensely. And, of course, there's an alienation often from your obviously fertile mothers, you know, the person that you feel that you can share everything with, but this time your mother hasn't had the problem conceiving, and here you are wanting to share with her what it feels like, and meanwhile her experience has been the being able to produce healthy, normal children or healthy children. So, again, a bit of an alienation in there. We have to be careful about the normal. What is? We won't talk about that for this. We'll save that normal for the next forum. Perhaps the biggest area of alienation or relationship breakdown has to do with yourself and your partner. Because we want our partners to feel what we are feeling, to understand what we are going through, and often that is not the case. We want them to not only be on the same page, as I always say, we want them to be right on the same line, understanding and feeling everything that we are going through. Great news for you guys, men and women process things differently. We just do. We're not the same. There are gender differences in the way we respond to crises. So for men, as a sweeping generalization, no offense here, guys, men tend to look for solutions. There's a problem, we're going to see the doctor, there's a solution, don't worry, things are going to happen. Women, we're a little different. We like to process, we like to think about it, we like to emote, we like to talk about it with our friends, we like to go back and think about it again, we like to go back and read a couple of more things on the internet, then we go back and check with our friends once again, and then we're thinking about very different places. And very often when we try to put the two things together, it doesn't happen because we're not in the same place at the same time. Not that he's not caring, but he's just not getting what it's like again for a woman to each month go through what it feels like when your body, when you get a period again, when you've hoped and prayed this month is going to be the month that it's not going to happen and you won't get your period. And as much as he feels for you, he doesn't understand what that feeling is about. And again, the partner issue, relationships can get stronger, they can get weaker, but a relationship when you're going through any life crisis cannot stay the same. And again, the problem with infertility is that on the outside, you look normal. Nobody sees that there's a problem. If you look at me, you don't know that I don't have fallopian tubes, that I had tubal pregnancies that ruined my fallopian tubes because I look pretty normal, a little old now maybe, but pretty normal. And then again, the other relationship that we enter into is our relationship often with God. Again, going back to how could this be happening to me? What did I do? Trying to find an explanation when there is no explanation along these lines. And then the final third component is our sense of our relationship with society at large. From a societal point of view, and perhaps even more so in this community, there is an expectation that we will be fruitful and we will be able to multiply. And if we are unable, And if things don't work out the way we have hoped and planned, then what is our role in society? Where do we fit in? And how do we cope with those feelings again? Because once again, we're hidden. We're silent, we're hidden. And I will suggest that even for some of people that may have wanted to come out tonight, there's even a bit of a concern that will I be identified as being infertile if I show up at a talk tonight that has something to do with infertility? You know, so we carry that because we want to be like everybody else. And my job and my role is to help bring, well, I help to support and to educate people around these areas. I help them to navigate the system and to be able to use the services of my esteemed colleagues to the best of their abilities. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Jen. So our next speaker is Sherry Levitin, who is a lawyer who practices here in Toronto. She's trained here in Toronto with a Bachelor of Science and a Bachelor of Laws. And she specializes in third-party reproductive technology. And she has the largest practice in this subspecialty of law of anybody in Canada. And basically her practice involves representing mainly infertile couples who are involved in third-party transactions with respect to their infertility, so having contracts with sperm donors, egg donors, or surrogate mothers. And as well, she consults to clinics, and she's a board member of the Infertility Awareness of Association of Canada. Thank you. And I'm sure you'll enjoy her talk, and if you don't get enough of her in tonight's talk and in the case studies, you can hear her again tomorrow morning at 7 a.m., on 99.1 CBC Radio, where she's going to be speaking on this topic. So now, without any further ado, Sherry.
Thank you. You know, in preparing for tonight's talk, I kind of went back to my roots at CHAT. And I remember, you know, the Jewish way of education was you get three fact situations, A, B, and C. And then you start asking questions. What if? And then you go back and you change A to A1. And you go back and you change B to B1. And you ask again, what if? And I have to tell you that the Canadian law is not quite that advanced. And so what we have is this regime that has not bothered to ask, what if? What will happen when? You know, and I often tell clients that I'm neurotic for a living because that's what I do all day long. I say, what will happen if? So what I'd like to do, you know, in my allotted 8 to 10 minutes, is to give you an overview of the Canadian law as it is, and then go to two issues that I find personally very, very interesting and that have more relevance to tonight, and that is the nature of gametes and the nature of embryos. So the law. We have virtually nothing in this country. We have, there are three ways to have law. And I know there's a lawyer in the audience, so somebody might challenge me on some of these things. We can have federal legislation. That would be legislation that applies across the country, although Quebec has a tendency of trying to opt out. We can have provincial legislation, so laws that apply only in that one particular province, and they tend to be quite different across the country. Or we can have cases. So people appear before a judge, and a judge makes a decision that becomes a precedent, and we try to either fit ourselves into that case or try to distinguish ourselves away from that case. And trial decisions tend to be very much about the people who are in front of the judge and that specific set of facts. But once you appeal it and you go to an appellate or even a Supreme Court type of tribunal, that's when we get precedents. That's when we get rules and fact situations that can really help us, guide us, you know, in future cases. We have in Canada the Assisted Human Reproduction Act, which is federal legislation. And it was really meant to do a couple of things. Mostly, it's about the clinics. It's going to license and regulate the clinics that provide these types of services. So it's consumer protection type legislation in that way. But as a hook, they threw in a few other things. There are also rules about stem cells, about cloning, that type of medical research. And there are a few sections that affect you, what I do every day, because there are rules about egg donation, embryo donation, and surrogacy. So in a nutshell, what they wanted to do was prevent the commodification. In the United States, in some states, this is big business. This is whatever time you show up, you pay your money, and you can get whatever you want. Not in every state, but there are some states where this thrives, and they wanted to avoid that. So the basic rules are, one cannot purchase eggs. So if you are an infertile couple and you need an egg donor, that donor has to do it on a basically altruistic basis. You cannot purchase. Note, it is not an offense for that woman to sell the eggs. It is only an offense for you to purchase them. Yes. Dilemma number one. On the embryo side, they made it a dual obligation. One cannot purchase, one cannot sell embryos. And whatever I say about eggs goes the same for sperm, because they've dealt with them the same. And on surrogacy, one cannot compensate a surrogate. One cannot pay her a fee that would induce the woman to carry a child for someone who is unable to carry a child. There's another section that deals with expenses. We can make sure that these people are not out of pocket. We can reimburse their expenses. But we still have no guidance on what types of expenses are permitted. So it's, at this point, just reasonable expenses. We have no provincial legislation that deals with this. In fact, no province does. And the provincial legislation would help us because it would tell us who a child's parents are. If you do A plus B, then X and Y are the parents, and we don't have that. All we have are common law presumptions that date back to the 1800s. That's how current we are, which says that if a woman gives birth, she is presumed to be the mother. It's a rebuttable presumption. We can go to court and overturn that presumption. If she is married or involved in a common law relationship, her partner or her husband is presumed to be the father. So if there's a couple and the husband is overseas working and they haven't seen each other for 3 years, but she gives birth, he is still presumed to be the father. We have virtually no case law in this country, which means no donor has ever come back and tried to assert rights to a child. No surrogate has ever tried to keep a child. I find that even more surprising. So we have none of the, you know, judges sitting and trying to decide who a child's parents should be. Our partners to the South have had many, many cases because they're just far more litigious. And the rule seems to be that a child's parents are the people who intended to be the child's parents. So they value very much what we call a preconception agreement, a contract, that is entered into before anybody gets pregnant. They take the intention out of that contract and they enforce it. Now, that's the overview. And that's what we use every day, and we use contracts to help define everybody's rights and obligations. What's interesting to me is trying to decipher what is a gamete, what is an egg, what is a sperm, what is an embryo. There was a case in Alberta 2 years ago. It was just a trial decision. It was never appealed, so it doesn't give us that wonderful precedent, but it's a good start. Man and a woman, boyfriend, girlfriend, never married, never lived together, simply a boyfriend and girlfriend, break up. That's where the story begins, when they break up. They stay friends. The woman wants to have a child. She asks the man for his help, and he agrees. Not sure what was in his mind, but I don't think it was 3 years of IVF, which is what they needed in order to conceive. She delivered twins, a boy and a girl. Now, when he agreed to donate sperm to her, he had two conditions. He said, I want to be recognized as the child's father, and I agree to pay child support. So he was a decent guy. Children are born, and he pays child support, double, exactly double what he had anticipated, but he does it. But the woman turned out to be somewhat of a protective mother, something I can identify with. And she didn't let him see the children as often as he wanted, and she wouldn't allow overnight visits. So they ended up with lawyers and a shared custody agreement. It was like a bad divorce for a couple that had never been married. The children are four, and they're back in court. And why are they back in court? She had three embryos left. She wanted to have another child. Now we're 7 years past the initial donation, and clearly he had no interest in that. And what the judge said was, sperm comes from one body. It belongs to that person. It's property. It's no different than a bottle of water. I can own it, and I can give it away. And if I give it away, I can't tell Jan what to do with it tomorrow. I've retained no legal rights to it. So this man donated the sperm. He gave it away. He understood what she was going to do with it. He cannot now, 7 years later, say, change my mind, deal's off. And so what the judge said was, this woman now owned the sperm. She owned the eggs because they came from her body, and he gave her the right to control the embryos. He did not say she owns the embryos, and courts won't go that far. But she won. There's been no follow-up, so I don't know if she conceived and whether he has to pay child support for a third child now. I want my water back. The last issue I want to deal with are those embryos, because this, to me, is where the law has to catch up. What are embryos? Are they life? Do we award custody of embryos the same way we would award custody of a child? Or are they property? You know, can you own an embryo and decide its fate? Now, in the States, they've had a fair number of divorce cases where the couple can decide about the house and the cars and the pets, but they can't decide about the fate of the embryos, and they are hotly contested cases. There is no single test that has come out of these cases, but the courts are loath to define what an embryo is. So they're not using property principles, and they're not using custody principles. In fact, what they're doing is they're weighing one person's right to procreate against another person's right not to. So it seems to me from the cases that what they're doing is they're looking at who wants the embryos and for what purpose. So if there was a divorce and there were embryos in cryopreservation, and if the woman, for example, wants to have them transferred to herself so that she can have a child, she is likely to win. If she wants to have them transferred or donated to a third party, she is likely not to win. So they're looking at where everybody is in that situation. Can someone procreate another way with their own genetic material or not? And then they weigh each party's rights and obligations and wishes and abilities. We have not had any such case in Canada, although I have been involved with a clinic where there was a miserable divorce, and the parties were so angry with each other that they couldn't decide what to do with the embryos. The woman was in her mid-40s. Her opportunity to create additional embryos with her own eggs had passed, so she wanted to use them. The husband, of course, they didn't have any children together during the marriage. He wasn't looking at, you know, 18 years of child support with a woman he was in the middle of a miserable divorce with. And so the husband, who I'm sorry to say was a lawyer, decided to try to sue the clinic, and that's where he directed his anger, and I represented the clinic, and every part of it was miserable. So prenups, anybody?
Hi, it's, okay, yes, I'm sorry. Thank you. It's not me. It's not my, well, I say hi in a nice way. It's a pleasure to introduce Rabbi Brander. We were in YU together, in yeshiva together. Rabbi Brander was an outstanding student and had a tremendous schut, the tremendous merit of being the meshames, the personal assistant of Rav Soloveitchik, really the last one of the meshamshin, the later years of the Rav in Yeshiva University, and of course developed a very close relationship and important relationship. Rabbi Brander served as the, I believe, assistant rabbi at Lincoln Square for a short time, and then he made his mark in Boca Raton, where he went to a fledgling beginning community of, I believe, under 50 couples. And 14 years later, when he left, there were over 600 families. He had started a day school, the Yeshiva High School, a kollel. He really has had a transformation of Florida, of South Florida, and He was handpicked by Richard Joel, the president of Yeshiva University, to come back to New York to be the dean of the Center of the Jewish Future, which, and we mentioned when he was last in Toronto, how he thought he was a busy rabbi in Florida. Now he knows what it really is to be a busy person, and it's really a tremendous honor that he took time out of his extremely busy schedule to come here. He is an expert, which I haven't mentioned yet, an expert in this field. He has a special smicha from Machon Pua, which is the Israeli center that, you know, deals on these issues. He has set up in Yeshiva University a training program for many of the smicha students to be trained in this area. So when we decided to have the program, there was really no better person to give a Jewish point of view on these issues. And I think he had a lot of food here for thought while, you know, he came in from the airport. So he'll try to give a perspective. We'll then take a short break. There's lots of food outside. And then we'll start the fun part of the evening, the case studies and the analysis and all the interesting cases that come up. So without further ado, thank you.
I want to begin by thanking Rabbi Kelman for inviting me. It's truly a privilege to be here and to share with you. It's been worth the flight already simply by hearing the people on the panel. I have benefited from hearing them, learning a little bit more about the litigious society of the United States and indeed the clarity of vision that they bring to the issues is rarely seen, and it really is truly a privilege to be on this panel with all of you. So I have 10 minutes to introduce some of the halachic issues, and they're no different than the challenge that my colleagues have had in introducing their issues in 10 minutes. And I'm reminded of a little story. A rabbi is flying on a plane. He's sitting next to an individual, and the person says to him, "Listen, Rabbi, I'm Jewish. I know very little bit about my Judaism, and I know that all of your years of study, the years that you studied in high school, those 4 or 5 years you study for ordination, they can basically all be summed up in one statement: love thy neighbor as you love yourself." The rabbi realizes that that statement, especially in last week's Torah portion, is extremely critical, extremely important, but it really doesn't summarize everything that he's done over his past many years of study. Turns to the person sitting next to him on the plane, he says, "And what do you do?" He says, "Rabbi, you really don't have a clue with what I do. I have two PhDs, and I'm an astrophysicist, and I've been studying for many, many years, and I'm sure you really don't understand that." And he says, "You know, you're right, but I understand that everything that you've studied, everything that you've done, all of your work, your two PhDs and all of the studies and research can be summarized in one statement: twinkle, twinkle, little star." So this is the twinkle, twinkle, little star version that my colleagues have had to give about some very important issues. The first thing is that it's important to recognize that God, that the whole idea of being able to actualize the dream of having a family through the gift of science really celebrates the capacity to use science to celebrate the idea that we're involved in tikkun olam, that the world was not created perfect, and we are involved with helping to perfect the world, whether it's dealing with the psychosocial issues, whether it's dealing with the legal issues or the medical issues. We are partners with God, and we imitate God through doing the activities that we can to make the world a little bit of a better place. There's a famous piece of Talmud that discusses an argument between Rabbi Akiva and the Roman governor of Judea. His name is Turnus Rufus. Turnus Rufus says that the Jewish people are condemned to hell for the following reason: they help the poor. Because suppose an earthly king had incarcerated one of his subjects and said that no one is to give this person any drink, and somebody snuck food to this person, would not the king be angry? And you, the Jewish people, are called the servants of God. Keli b'nei Yisrael v'dayhem. You're the servants of God. So Rabbi Kiva responds to Turnus Rufus and says, "Well, suppose the earthly king had incarcerated his child and said that no one is to give his child any food or drink, and someone snuck food or drink to his child. Would not the king really be happy that someone saved his child? And we, the Jewish people, are also called the children of God. B'nim atem l'Hashem Elokeichem." Rabbi Soloveitchik once explained that this conversation between Turnus Rufus and Rabbi Akiva is much more than a conversation. It's a philosophical challenge. When we deal with challenges within the world, do we wear the glasses of God? Do we say, well, if a person is condemned to a certain stature regarding finances or a certain predicament regarding the inability to actualize the dream of having a family, do we simply say, well, that's what God willed, we wear the glasses of God, and anyone who tries to change it is condemned to hell because what right do you have to interact with what God has decreed? That is not the Jewish way. The Jewish way is the way that is articulated by Rabbi Akiva, and that is we never wear the glasses of God. We never ask the question of why bad things happen to good people, why challenging things happen to good people, because simply we don't always have those answers to those questions. The question that is more appropriate to ask is when challenging things happen to special people, how do you deal with those challenges? And it's not up to us to make the decisions of what God has orchestrated, although many of us will be able to ask God questions. I have a list of questions in my palm to ask God after 120 years. And they're important questions, but they're not questions that I can answer now. But they are important questions. But our goal and our agenda in life is to be able to change the society around us through the gifts of psychology, through the gifts of science, through the gifts of law, and to find ways to make the world a better place. It's interesting that the Talmud says that after 120 years, there's a list of questions that one is asked when one faces the heavenly court. The first question is, Tzipita LeYeshua, did you wait for the redemption? Were you part of the process, or God forbid, part of the problem? The next question is asked, is Asakta Bapiria Varivya, were you involved in procreation? Notice the language of the Talmud. The language of the Talmud is not Kiyamta Piriya Varivya, did you fulfill the obligation of having children? Because that's not within our hands. Sometimes we have the ability to do it, sometimes we don't. The question is Asakta. Did you try? And if you tried, that if you had children, or if you did not have children, that's not in your hands. That's in the hands of God. And one should not feel that one has a certain responsibility other than trying to have children to the best of one's ability. However, if one wishes to use the gifts of science, that is, one is not mandated, but if one wishes to use the gifts of science to actualize the dream of having a family, there are a whole bunch of challenges that go with that also. First of all, let's start from the beginning of the process. How does one check the issues of infertility? Are there any challenges, halachic challenges, religious challenges, when one needs to do a sperm analysis, when a man has to express sperm for the sole purpose of testing the sperm for its morphology, for its structure, and for its capacity to be able to be involved in procreation? What happens if ovulation happens prematurely because a woman is using the mikvah, and because she's using the mikvah, her capacity to be able to have children is compromised because ovulation is happening before she goes to the mikvah? How does one define maternity? Is maternity defined by the egg donor, a case in which the role of the mother in some ways is bifurcated, where the egg is being donated by one mother and there is a host mother that nurtures the fertilized egg? What defines maternity? The genetic gift or the nurturing of the fetus? What defines paternity? Is the definition of paternity simply just a sperm donation? And what happens if conception happens posthumously? A person goes off to war. Before he goes off to war, he decides that he's going to express some sperm in case, God forbid, something happens. His wife gets a phone call, tragic telegram, that he has passed away. And the wife says, you know what? In order to remember my husband, the hero, I want to have a child that celebrates his legacy. And so therefore his sperm that is being frozen in a sperm bank, I want to use that sperm and go through a procedure like IUI in order to be able to have a child. So the father is not even alive at the time of conception. is that person the father? When the child is born, if the father was a Kohen, is the child a Kohen? Does the child say Kaddish, the Yahrzeit of his father, who was never even alive, even for the moment of his conception? Does the father and the child have any relationship when it comes to issues of inheritance and things of that nature? What happens when one has the opportunity to go through the process of IVF? And coupled with the process of IVF and vitro fertilization, there can be an additional process known as PGD, pre-implantation genetic diagnosis, where what could happen is in the blastocyst stage of the development of the embryo, third or fourth day or so, what could happen is, I hate talking in front of doctors about these issues, so if I'm making a mistake, please stop me.
You're doing a good job.
Okay. I'm not the dean of Einstein Medical School. I'm the dean of the rabbinical school. There's a big difference. And what happens if the following thing happens? If the couple decides, listen, we have a bunch of boys at home. We'd like a princess in our home. And so what you can do with PGD is you can take a fertilized egg and you can tell the genetic makeup. You can tell whether it will be a boy or a girl. You can tell whether it will have certain genetic challenges. And let's say based on the results of the test, you decide which embryos to return and which ones to destroy. Is that permitted to do? Let's say the following case. This is a true case. A couple lives in a very right-wing Orthodox community. The husband has no capacity to give sperm. So what happens is they use a non-Jew as a sperm donor. Her eggs are harvested, eggs are fertilized, and they decide they only want girls, not boys. Why? Because what will happen is the husband is a Kohen. The child will not be a Kohen. The child will be a Yisrael. So 13 years later, when the child is being called up for bar mitzvah, he won't be called up as the first aliyah. He'll be called up for the third aliyah or for the final aliyah. And so they don't want that challenge. So they decide the only thing they want are girls, not boys. Do you have a right? Where does the role of being the partner of God end and playing the role of God begin? Is PGD permitted when it comes to genetic challenges and perhaps not permitted when you want to be involved with having the perfect family or to try to choreograph a way in which you fulfill the mitzvah of having both a male and female child? And then the issue of who owns the embryos is an extremely important issue. What is the status of the embryos of the fertilized eggs before they're returned? Do they have a halachic status of a human being or not? And let me just end my comments with actually sharing with you a verse within the Bible. A verse within the Bible, sometimes we think the Bible is something that is just archaic and doesn't really play a role in our life. But this verse within the Bible, these two verses in the Bible, is really the standoff between the House of Representatives and the White House. There's many standoffs right now between the House of Representatives and the White House, in case you're not aware of it. This is just one of them. Allow me to read the text and at one point help me translate. V'chi yinatsu anashim, if two men are fighting, v'nakfu hi'isha hara, and they hit by accident a woman who's pregnant, v'yatsu yiladeha v'lo yiya ason. V'yatsu yiladeha v'lo yiya ason. Can someone translate the word v'yatsu yiladeha? V'yatsu yiladeha v'lo yiya ason. Anyone? She miscarried. What else can the word v'yatsu yilada mean? She gave birth. So let's read the text the following way. V'chi yinatsu anashim v'nakfu isha hara. Two people are fighting, two men are fighting, they hit a woman who's pregnant, v'yatsu yilada. She gives birth prematurely. V'lo yiya ason, nothing happens to the fetus. Just premature. Anosh yonesh kashe yasis ala ba'al isha v'natam b'filim. Still, the people who were fighting need to pay for damages. The woman gave birth prematurely. They have to evaluate the challenges to the fetus, to the baby, and the challenges to the family due to this premature birth. V'im ason yiyeh, But if, God forbid, there is an ason, which in this case means if there was a miscarriage, v'nasata nefesh tachas nefesh, then there can be capital punishment. If you read the text this way, the way I read it, which is the way this text is translated in Latin and translated by most of the Catholic Church, then all of a sudden you have defined the definition of life from the moment in which an egg is fertilized. And therefore stem cell research becomes a great challenge. It is all based on how you read these verses. We don't read these verses the way I just articulated. We read the verses the way the man in the back seat articulated, and that was "V'chiinatzu anashim," when two men are fighting, "V'nakfu isha hara," and they hit a woman, "V'yatzu yiladeha," and she miscarries, "V'lo yi'ason," and nothing other than the miscarriage happened to her. Then, since the fetus was lost, and the fetus is not yet a life, it's a limb. So when there's a loss of limb, there has to be monetary punishment, monetary compensation. However, v'imasoniya, if the woman was killed, then there's capital punishment. How you read those two verses in the Bible defines whether there is a challenge for stem cell research, defines the difference between the Jewish perspective and the Christian right regarding the whole notion of the definition of an embryo. We feel that at the early stages of embryonic development, it is not yet considered a human being, whereas the Christian church, the way they translate these verses, feel something totally different. It's all in the Masorah. It's all in the tradition of how you read those two verses. Obviously, the psychosocial issues are as important as any issue that I just mentioned. All of the issues of sensitivity, of recognition, of the challenges that go through when a couple wishes to actualize a dream of having a family, and the challenges that happen thereof, are also part of our halachic context. But if I may end with the following. While we live in a challenging moment regarding dealing with these contemporary issues and making sure there's a hand-in-glove relationship with Jewish law, what is exciting is the capacity for Jewish law to be able to engage in these issues based on principles that have been established for thousands of years and to be able to meet the challenges of contemporary scientific issues. It is important that we as a traditional community understand that one does not need to live a bifurcated existence, but rather the responsibility to understand the science, to understand the medicine, and to recognize that when one understands the science and medicine, one can look at the Jewish tradition and the Jewish values and to realize the hand-in-glove relationship that there can be with the science and with the Jewish law, which truly celebrates the eternality of the Jewish tradition. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much, Rabbi Brander, for those very interesting words. Our 10-minute break has now been cut to 6 minutes, so that we can move the evening as long along as we previously said. So it's now 8:05, according to that clock, EYT, Eastern Yekka time. We're going to be here sharp 8:11. Please go enjoy yourself desserts up there in the foyer.